Good morning, everybody. Welcome to ESG in the C-Suite, Future-Proofing Asian Companies Through Corporate Governance. This is Teneo's third and last webinar in this ESG in the C-Suite series. We previously discussed the E and the S pillars, and so we now move to G, corporate governance, a measure of the internal fitness of a company, which we believe allows it to stay faithful to its E and S commitments. The concept of corporate governance has been around for decades, making it the oldest of the three ESG pillars. However, it can be argued that we haven't seen the same pace of progress in the G pillar in recent years, especially compared to what we've observed in the E pillar, especially in the lead up to and right after COP26. Today, we will try to unpack what needs to change in the governance approach so that Asian companies can evolve and face the future as stronger companies. Joining us today are distinguished representatives from Hong Kong Exchange and Clearing, Singapore Exchange, MTR, and Teneo Strategy and Community. We have Kelly Lee, Vice President Policy and Secretariat Services, Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing Limited. Kelly joined the exchange in 2013 and has been involved in their major listing policy initiatives in recent years. Prior to joining Hong Kong Exchange, Kelly practiced corporate and securities law in Hong Kong. Michael Tang, Head of Listing Policy and Product Admission at Singapore Exchange Regulation, a subsidiary of Singapore Exchange. They undertake frontline regulatory functions, oversees listing policy and rules development, and has oversight of the listing admission of securities products, including debt securities, structured products, and exchange-traded funds. We also have Jill Meller, Legal and Governance Director of MTR Corporation. Jill is responsible for overseeing the company's legal, company secretarial, insurance and risk management functions, and a central procurement and supply chain function. She is also responsible for MTR's overall ESG strategy. She is a vice chairman of the legal committee of the Hong Kong General Chamber of Commerce, a member of the Standing Committee on Company Law Reform, and immediate past president and ex officio council member of the Hong Kong Chartered Governance Institute. And finally, we've got Lauren Chung, CEO Strategy and Communications Advisory, Teneo. Lauren has extensive experience advising CEOs and leaders on achieving their strategic goals while navigating high-stakes business and stakeholder engagement situations. She has advised private, public, and social sector leaders on a range of critical affairs, including corporate strategy, ESG strategy, policy advocacy, and public affairs. I am Patricia Heiberger, Managing Director at Teneo, and I will be moderating today's discussion. So our first question for everyone. At the recent World Economic Forum in Davos, prominent members of the business community warned that increasing the ESG compliance burden on companies could prevent more small, medium enterprises from committing to sustainability. The CEO of Unilever said that they are struggling with the most basic ability to measure difficult to measure areas. And the Hong Kong Exchange Chairman Laura Cha said, disclosure requirements need to be more meaningful. My question to everyone is twofold, actually. Where are Asian companies in terms of their corporate governance journey, and what needs to change to help them leave the box-ticking compliance mindset behind? And to the regulators, how do you respond to earnest complaints from companies about being burdened by having too many rules to follow? So those are my questions. They're pretty meaty. We can start with Jill as a someone representing companies. Where do you think companies are in the journey?
I think, look, we've come a long way in Hong Kong and in Asia more broadly, but I would probably say on balance, we still lag behind some other areas of the world in terms of good corporate governance. And I'm sure during the discussion today, we'll explore a little bit more about what we might mean by good corporate governance. Certainly, you know, MTR is a large company who has the resources to deal with disclosures and reporting requirements. I think the points raised at Davos about disclosures needing to be meaningful, I think are incredibly important. And I think in lots of the rules and disclosure requirements are often on a comply or explain basis. And I think perhaps companies need to be a little bit bolder in terms of being prepared to explain why something is not relevant to their business and therefore why they are not reporting on it or reporting on it in full. I think sort of to date, there's been this sense of we need to answer every question that's asked. And so if we can move away from that, and I agree, make the disclosures a little bit more meaningful, although it is difficult in some areas, and particularly, I know you discussed the S part of ESG on a previous call, disclosures around S are, you know, are very challenging. But I think be bolder, disclose where it matters and it's relevant to your business, and make the disclosures there, therefore a bit more meaningful.
Can we move now to Lauren before we ask the question of regulators?
Sure, thanks, Patricia. So just to give listeners a little bit of context about Teneo, so we're an advisory firm that partners with the C-suite and leaders of businesses to do great things for better futures. So we operate across five advisory verticals, so strategy and communications, management consulting, financial advisory, risk advisory, and people advisory. Footprint-wise, we're in 40 markets globally, but in Asia, our perspective and our offices span Tokyo, Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Singapore, Sydney, and Melbourne. In the Asia region, we've been advising, working with CEOs and boards on governance-related issues for the last 10 years. So I just wanted to give you sort of that context of the Teneo perspective. So at the heart of your question, I suppose, Patricia, is, you know, are there too many rules? Are companies sort of buckling under the weight of too many rules? And I, you know, personally, I reject the notion of corporate governance as a compliance activity. You know, it's an overall framework, a set of principles and procedures that ensures a company delivers on its obligations to all stakeholders. And Patricia, you mentioned Davos. And just having a look through sort of Davos's recent material, I particularly like the way that they frame corporate governance. And if you just give me a moment, I'll read it out. So the corporate governance should ensure decision making in the best interest of all stakeholders, including customers, employees, regulators, local communities and shareholders. This applies both during periods of relative stability and during crises, when many organizations will be forced to confront how well they have or have not prepared for a corporate governance standpoint. Good governance relies on internal mechanisms like the structure of a board and incentives for management, and on external mechanisms such as institutions that demand accountability. So all of these mechanisms are important as they form the core of how and for whom corporations generate value. So ultimately, corporate governance can help deliver both economic gains and more inclusive societies. So I just wanted to read that out because I think it's a really nice framing of sort of where we are in the corporate governance conversation at the moment. Do I see too many rules as the problem? No, I'm personally a big one for mandating change. Again, working with organizations over the last 15 years, the pace of change in, you know, not, you know, I'm based in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, like other markets, I think the pace of change has been somewhat unsatisfactory. But my observation is that companies are now recognizing the increased need for corporate governance disclosures. And there's kind of a deep introspection taking place at the C-suite level. The right conversations are being held. So there's that awareness now, and I think there is movement on it. But yes, it's still slow.
Can I go now to Kelly and then Michael about what their take is about this journey?
Yeah, thank you, Patricia. I want to say that I echo what Lauren just said. To us, I mean, the corporate governance code, we have introduced this code for more than 20 years. And what we want to do is to provide a framework setting out the overarching principles for our companies to follow. They are not really, it's just like you will never have an exhaustive list for what you should do in order to have good corporate governance. It's good, you can see that it's just some suggestions or some widely accepted ways that you can achieve good corporate governance. And that's where we are coming from. And exactly this why we want to allow our listed companies the flexibility to suit their own circumstances by using the comply or explain provisions, so that they, as Jill said, if you think that's not relevant to you, just provide your explanation. I think it's really important, because the key is to give your shareholders, your stakeholders, meaningful information to allow them to understand where you are at your corporate governance level, and so that they can evaluate your performance. I think this is the key. It's kind of as a communication thing. It's not just a rules taking. Yeah.
And Michael, you were saying something very interesting about the SGX approach yesterday when we were talking about it. Like, what's kind of the principles guiding the SGX when they're thinking about this corporate governance journey that companies are going through? Sorry, Michael, I think you are on mute.
Hi, can you hear me better?
Yes, we can hear you now. Perfect.
Despite all the tech rants and pet, I still face problems with technology. But I was saying, thanks for having me here today, this morning, and good morning to all of you. Before I begin, I thought I would share some context about ESG, given that this is a series of ESG seminars. And Patricia, you mentioned about how corporate governance seems to have lagged behind concerns of environment and society factors. And I think it's interesting to know that the term ESG was only coined less than 20 years ago. And the whole idea is to put environmental and social issues same footing as corporate governance issues. Given that corporate governance has been an area of development for the last few decades, much more than our thinking around environment and society, and what impacts companies have on these aspects. So really, when we look at ESG, we're looking at how we can utilize the internal structures within the company to achieve KPIs, to achieve performance. These performance straddles both business performance as well as sustainability performance. Because in the long run, we believe that sustainability factors actually affects business performance. And I think that would be one of my responses to SMEs, to smaller companies, looking at sustainability as a compliance issue and struggling with complying with these disclosure requirements. That really what we are asking for in asking companies to produce a report is to think about the future, think about the potential risks and opportunities that spans ESG aspects that will pose a burden or maybe an opportunity for you to leverage upon in your business APIs. And I think the other thing I'll add is that as an approach, we in Singapore do want to adopt a phased one where we allow companies to progressively adopt my practices. First, get onto the journey and start looking at things from a sustainability perspective or from a more holistic governance perspective, and then slowly improve upon those practices. And this is also reflected in the regulations, regulatory framework that we have, which is, I think, is very similar to what in Hong Kong as well. We have mandatory listing rules, which sets baseline standards. But on top of that, we have the Code of Corporate Governance, which sets principles and tenets of what a good corporate governance looks like, and set out some provisions and practices that companies are encouraged to adopt. And there's flexibility for companies to choose to deviate from these proposed recommended practices, so long as they explain what else they do instead, to also fulfill the spirit behind the corporate governance principles. And in 2018, cognizant of the fact that this whole code has become maybe a bit more burdensome and thick, we actually went through an exercise to streamline code, which I believe is quite unheard of in, I guess, regulatory books, taking away provisions, really distilling down to the most important factors and principles to ask companies to look at and to spend time thinking about, and then putting rest of it into best practice.
It's good to hear how you're responding. And, you know, like you said, it's kind of unheard of for a regulator to take away rules rather than add to it. I wanted to talk about the concept of culture. You know, everyone who thinks about corporate governance thinks about it as a compliance thing. But I know that at least with the Hong Kong Exchange, they're trying to move companies to a culture mindset versus a compliance mindset. So maybe, Kelly, can you spend maybe a minute or two just talking about what you guys are doing, and then we'll dwell on the concept of culture a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I think going back to what I said, as a regulator, I think we can always push out rules to ask companies to do more, right? But then what we want to do is moving away from the box ticking mode and seeing that the company really drive the change from within the company itself from the top. And that's why our requirements that come into effect earlier this year, we want to instill the mindset change, this concept into the board of directors. And about the culture, I think what we want to highlight is that the role of the board in shaping and also in leading the culture that supports the purposes and the values of your company. That's the important thing that you should do. We are not saying that, oh, we need to codify. There's a set of culture that you need to codify or you need to set it. But instead, you should understand what your company's culture is, because you are the one who set the purposes and values and strategies of the company, and how you can map them together, how you can align them together. And we believe that if these are properly aligned, then it will have a lot of energy for you to foster the company's capacity to thrive for success.
That's very interesting, Kelly. And just a little plug for Teneo. This is something that we do on an almost day-to-day basis with our clients. We help them look at their company culture and map it against their company strategy and find a resonance. And, you know, I want to spend some more time on this concept of culture, and then turn it on in its head and ask, is there a fundamental clash of cultures in Asia when it comes to corporate governance topics? Think about things like board independence, board tenure, minority shareholder protections. On the surface, aren't these antithetical to the typical Asian company? You know, typical Asian company is family owned or state backed, right? That describes the majority of the Asian companies that we have at present. So I wonder what you guys think about, you know, corporate governance culture and Asian culture sat side by side. And I wonder if I can present this to Jill first, and then maybe Michael or Lauren can also contribute.
Sure. So I think there is certainly more work to be done in this part of the world. I think in some ways to explain the benefits of some of those things you just touched on. So particularly, for example, diversity. You know, there's been a lot of work done, I'm sure, by Teneo and around the world, showing that companies with diverse boards are more creative, more innovative, deliver better financial performance. And I think some of those benefits perhaps, you know, are not fully understood in the Asian market yet. Having said that, though, I don't think any company, whether it's family-owned or state-owned, is kind of immune from the broader changes in the landscape that mean that our governance frameworks need to develop to take account of all stakeholder interests, you know, that need to move from compliance to doing sort of what's the right thing. You know, and I often talk about the front page test. You know, when you're making a decision as a company, you know, what's it going to look like if that's on the front page of the SCMP or the Straits Times tomorrow morning? And it's quite a good sort of test to sit back and think, gosh, have we really balanced different stakeholder interests here? And I think then to have a governance framework that enables you to do that, you know, you have to take account of both the the sort of hard internal controls, the rules, the regulations, the processes you have, but the soft internal controls, which is really where it comes back to culture. And so I think because we're all, you know, whoever we're owned by, we are all subject to that broader external pressure. And I think that's only increasing. I think it's beholden on all of us to really take a look at our internal control frameworks, hard and soft, to make sure that we can be doing the right thing.
Thanks, Jill. Michael?
I don't think that corporate governance principles that you've espoused, actions or independent boards, being diverse boards, that these are antithetical to how our Asian companies are structured. Although a large majority of Asian companies are family owned, but they do take public monies when they seek a listing on public exchanges, and really therein lies the accountability that needs to be in place in order for companies and boards and directors to acknowledge that there are certain shareholder interests, minority shareholder interests that are important, and that is, those are the rules that we've entered into, that if a director enters into a related party transaction, this is subject to further scrutiny. If a company intends to enter into major transactions, that's again subject to shareholders' approval. And these are, I think, the rules of the game in order to ensure that minorities who are putting monies and investing in companies feel assured that their investments are safeguarded and subject to scrutiny.
Thanks, Michael. I wanted to pause here to remind the audience that you can actually send in questions. So use the chat function to send in questions, and we'll compile all of them and moderate for our Q&A at the end of this discussion. And then now, that's the end of my plug. I want to pick up on something that Jill mentioned, which is diversity in boards. I'm very proud of how diverse we are on this panel. I wish a lot of Asian boards were as diverse as we are. What are the leaders of Asian companies thinking about on the topic of diversity? Jill already mentioned some of it in her previous answer, but I was just wondering from Kelly's and Michael's or even Lauren's perspectives, when you're talking about diversity with Asian companies, what's the conversation like? What are the pushbacks? What's the hurdle, the mental hurdle that they're having in this discussion? Maybe we can start with Kelly.
Sure. I think the companies that we engage, they normally do recognize that the benefits of having a diverse board, as Joe mentioned already, there are a lot of researchers and publications out there talking about how a diverse board can help the companies to manage changes. And I think in particular, the pandemic, all those challenges that posed by the pandemic, it also demonstrate that if you have a more diverse board, how more agile that the company can be during the time of crisis. And I think at the exchange, what we want to emphasize is that as a listed company, your board of directors, that you should have the right mix of individuals with the appropriate talents, experience, and skill set that is suitable for your company. And in terms of diversity, it has been our focus for promoting in the past few years. And since 2019, we require all the listed companies in our market to have a board diversity policy, and also with setting targets on how to achieve better diversity. And we do see improvement in this aspect, and we are encouraging to see that the percentage of listed companies that having at least one female directors on board have increased by 5% since our introduction of that rule, and is up to like 72% as of this month. So we do see that there's an improvement in here. We get more buy-in from the management and also all directors. And I understand that in MTR, they even set a very good target in terms of what they can achieve in terms of the board mix. And I think this is a journey, as Michael has said. I think the whole corporate governance, no matter its diversity, everything is a journey, and we require the long-term commitment from the directors as well. And so this year, our latest requirements is that we end to single gender board, and we definitely want to further improve or promote this diversity concept among our listed companies.
Yeah. And Jill, Kelly mentioned that you guys had set targets. Can you expand on those targets and tell us how you got there in the end?
Sure. So MTR, we have a fairly large board. It has always been relatively diverse, and I have to say our chairmen have been very open to their recognition of the benefits of diversity. But I think in terms of the targets, I have to say thank you to Kelly and the Exchange, because the change to the corporate governance code at the end of last year, which required companies set numerical targets, meant that I could go in and have that conversation with my chairman. And so we've recently announced that we will have no less than 20% women on our board, with a target of 25% by 2025, which is fantastic. But there is a huge amount to do in Hong Kong in this space. Kelly was talking about improving numbers, but I think we still have around 800 of 2,500 listed companies that have single gender boards, you know, and progress really has been glacial over the last sort of 5 to 10 years. And so I think, you know, a huge amount to do here.
And what does it look like in Southeast Asia, Michael? What's the conversation about diversity at the board level or at the management level?
I was just observing that amongst us, we do not have a single gender panel, which is good, but I guess that probably is the other way around, that we're looking at lots of them. But I think the way that we look at diversity is to first, obviously, is about the disadvantaged factors. But the other, I think, important facet of diversity is really focused on making sure that our boards, our management, have the sufficiently diverse perspective in order to ride through crises, as we have seen these days, in order to achieve better outcomes by anticipating things that may not be observed or perceived if we're all the same. So I think from the governance perspective, diversity is also important, and that is why we've introduced requirements quite similar to what Hong Kong has in terms of requiring companies to produce reports on their diversity policies, targets, and timelines to achieve these targets. At the national level in Singapore, there are national targets set by the Council on Board Diversity, which is a cross-sector representation from industry to public sectors. And what they've recommended is that we should have at least 20% of women on boards by 2020 and 30% by 2030. I think at last count in the end of December, we are almost at 20%. So I think there's some ways to go. But in terms of, I think, the conversations that the rule change has, precipitated amongst the boardroom, that definitely has improved, that there is definitely now more discussions about looking at the board matrix, the matrix of skills that the board currently possesses, and whether or not that's suitable for the board. And then at the point of renewal of directors, to start looking at filling those gaps. I think, again, it's a journey, but it's one that I think is precipitated by certain rule changes, but also I think a change in societal norms, what investors, what society feels is right.
I want to pick up on that and then move on to the next question and pose it first to Lauren. So we've now all agreed, we're all in consensus that box ticking or the compliance mindset is not the best way to embed good corporate governance in companies. So what is an alternative way, Lauren? What have you seen works with companies who are taking this more seriously or taking it to heart?
So what I see and what I believe is that it's all forms of activism from all stakeholders that's needed, you know, not just shareholders. It's from employees, customers, governments, regulators to, you know, to affect the kind of, you know, change that we need. You know, looking at, you know, employees specifically, you know, a conversation that really dominates the agenda at the moment with our clients is the great resignation, and that, you know, attracting, retaining employees is the biggest challenge. So people want to work for good companies. They want to work for well-run companies, companies with a purpose, where leadership leads by example, where the board of directors reflect the diversity of the employee and the customer base. If they don't like what they see, then they look for employment elsewhere. So I think that employee activism is a really powerful form of, you know, affecting change. You know, and specifically on shareholder activism, I think this is also critical. So activist shareholders have traditionally, you know, as we all know, had a tougher time in Asia due to sort of the makeup of, you know, often sort of family run or state controlled companies. But, you know, we've been involved in a few situations recently, and for context, Tanea is always on the side of representing the corporate. We don't work with activist shareholders, but we have been involved representing a number of Asian companies recently where there has been an activist shareholder in the register. And what we've observed through these situations is that pressure from the activist has led again to, as I mentioned earlier, so this deep introspection within the upper ranks and the, you know, the shareholder, the controlling shareholders of the company. And they're having the right conversations. They're really analyzing their vulnerabilities and looking at ways that they can make change to sort of meet that shareholder, that activist shareholder in the middle. So I think this that shareholder activism can be really, really positive. And play a constructive role in corporate governance reform within, you know, organizations in Asia.
That's quite a controversial take, Lauren, but I think I agree with you in that, you know, that's one way that corporate governance can be shaped in Asia. We saw it in the US and we saw it in Europe. We're starting to see it in Japan and Australia. I guess it's just a matter of time to see it become more effective in Southeast Asia and Hong Kong. And the mainland, maybe. Michael, I wanted to ask you about Singapore specifically, because we know that shareholder activism has become more and more of a topic in Singapore. So what are you seeing there from your perspective as a regulator and also just someone who's observing the changes in corporate governance there? Like, what's the role that activism is playing in Singapore at the moment?
I think historically, we've had a culture of shareholder activism, I would say, for more than 20 years at a Securities Investors Association in Singapore, yes, that represents the interests of retail shareholders. And what they're able to do is to unite these voices and to bring these concerns to the boardrooms of companies and to engage in discussions with. I would say definitely this not as maybe adversarial as some other jurisdictions, but there is an engagement between retail investors and the boards of companies, directors, in order to address these concerns raised by retail investors. I think in recent times, the ability of shareholders to find each other on social media, on these social media platforms, have really also galvanized action and within these shareholder groups. And I think as a regulator, what we want to do is to facilitate this discussion between shareholders and companies, but also have people realize and recognize that there are certain things which cannot be fixed by rules or regulations. For example, if there are concerns with business decisions that do not fall foul of the rule, there are concerns with commercial I guess, views on things of where the company is going. These are things that should be discussed and raised at shareholder meetings or between shareholders and company. But from a regulatory perspective, there's quite little that we can do because we do not operate in a merit-based regime. We operate in one where disclosure is made to shareholders, and it is for shareholders to take those decisions based on the information that's been disclosed.
Thanks, Michael. And I wanted to talk about the future of. So what are the corporate governance trends we should be expecting in the next 5 or so years, and also the future of Asian companies? How will the next generation of corporate leaders respond, you know, whether leaders of family-driven or state-owned company? Because we are seeing, at least from Taneo's perspective, we are seeing a generational shift in the leadership of a lot of Asian companies. So I'm just curious to see or to hear what you think the next 5 years in terms of corporate governance will be. And maybe I'll start with Kelly and then move on to Lauren.
I think the trend is definitely there's increasing demand, as Lauren, Michael has just said, no matter it's from shareholders or other stakeholders, they are demanding more and more in terms from the company, either from the disclosure perspective or the in terms of communication, how the performance is, how they structure the governance or manage the risk. Definitely, these are the increasing the demand from the market is growing. And so this is definitely a good push for the company to do better governance in this regard. And I think from our exchange, from the exchange perspective, I think diversity, directors' independence, or how to even increasing more minority shareholders' protection will definitely still be on the agenda that we will continue to drive. And I think maybe you guys already talk about it in the e webinar. And I think as you are aware that in the market, I think still the focus will still be on the environmental aspect, especially the climate aspect. And as the exchange, we will still focus on that bit in the coming 5 to 10 years, I think.
Thanks, Kelly. Lauren?
So I would agree with everything Kelly said. And for me, there's sort of five clear areas I see will be in focus, you know, over the years ahead. So absolutely board oversight of ESG. Then the past, as we know, investors have tended to care mainly about those traditional corporate governance issues, board composition, skill set, tenure, remuneration. But the focus, you know, we see is definitely turning to how boards are governing ESG efforts, the growing expectations of companies to disclose and communicate how they're governing the ESG strategy, their net zero goals and their social agendas. And that leads me to net zero progress. I think there's going to be a sharpening focus on net zero progress. You know, we've seen the last 12, 18 months, everyone come out and make these commitments, which is wonderful. But investors and others are going to want to know, okay, so what have you achieved against those goals? Organizational purpose, I think it's something that's been touched on by a few of the panelists. So I think a company's declared purpose and the effect that that purpose has on organizational operations will continue to be in the spotlight. I think there'll be an increased emphasis on how corporate governance principles are serving stakeholders more broadly. Two other points would be governing against disruption and resilience. So how the first being, you know, how organizations are positioned to governance against all the disruptions that we see in the world and will continue to see. What structures do they have in place to protect the company for the long term, for the, what is it, the known unknowns or the unknown unknowns, I should say, but then can still govern for the short term as well. I think that's a really tricky balance that's going to be monitored. And then finally, corporate resilience. You know, and that links to the former point around disruption, but do you have the right corporate governance structures in place to see that company through change and uncertainty? And then finally, how will, you know, next generation corporate leaders respond? I think for many, particularly startups, this is innate, that understanding that the organization exists beyond just meeting shareholder return needs. It exists for so many different reasons and to ultimately benefit society. I think that's innate in many of the founders, founder-run businesses in Asia at the moment, the younger generation companies. But I think it'll be interesting to watch the transition of second and third generation family members that are taking over some of the big corporates in Asia and how they transition or adapt their corporate governance structures to meet, you know, the current context of the world that we live in. So that would be my
interesting picture. A lot to unpack. Maybe I can ask Michael what his take is on the future of what's your crystal ball telling you. Well, maybe not crystal ball because you're the regulator.
so I think sustainability and governance. Sustainability, I think we see greater agreement amongst markets on what reporting standards should be adopted with the Sustainability Standards Board, having recently released a draft of their latest recommendations. I think specifically for boards, it's really understanding and disclosing the board's capability in dealing with climate risks. And sustainability risk. I think that's something that boards would probably need to take note of. Is the company and specifically the leadership of the company equipped to deal with these emergent risks? I think other aspect on governance in terms of trends I would see is maybe a further conversation on independence, especially of long-tenured directors, independent directors. I think different jurisdictions have a different approach. Some set a hard length of service, years, length of years of service that an independent director can serve, while others take a different approach, like ours, where we ask shareholders to decide after a certain years. I think there'll be a further conversation on that just because proper, I think, management of this question on long tenured directors would also help in looking at board renewals, also help in looking at diversity of boards. So I think that's something that I'll see further conversations on.
Thanks, Michael. And then finally, Jill, what's the future?
Sure, and look, the other speakers have touched on so many areas already, but I'll just perhaps pick up a couple if I may. I think one is going to be an increased focus on the S pillar of ESG, and particularly I think for Asian companies, which, and I generalise, I know, a lot of them have dealt with the S pillar through a family foundation and the like, and so I think there's going to be a push for people to think about the social pillar a little bit more strategically. And somebody suggested to me the other day, we might almost move to a scope 1, 2, and 3 social impact assessment. So thinking about what are your direct impacts on society, what are your indirect impacts, what are the impacts throughout your supply chain, which really forced people, I think, to sort of operationalize and internalize S as opposed to it being, the charitable donations. And the other area that I would mention, I think, is this continued kind of need to balance ES and G, and indeed, corporate efficiency, corporate resilience and sustainability. And Lauren talked about the governance of ENS, and I think this is going to be an area that just gets continued focus. I think at the Unilever AGM recently, there was pushback from one shareholder to kind of say that they'd gone too far in saying that not only did they have to have a corporate purpose, but each individual product, I think the one they quoted was Hellmann's mayonnaise, had to have its own purpose. And so there was this sense, this had all gone too far. And so I think that need for companies to have an appropriate corporate governance framework that lets them balance, financial sustainability, environmental and social sustainability. And really importantly, as some of the other speakers touched on, resilience through times of disruption is going to be really critical. And it's not something you ever get right. I think it's a continued balancing act for boards as their business changes and as societal demands change. So it's an exciting time ahead.
Thanks, Jill. I have some interesting questions coming from the audience. And one of them speaks to something that you just said, Jill. So I'm going to pose it to everyone in case you guys have thoughts as well. A question from the audience. Do you think that we're trying too hard to thread the camel into the needle by trying to compartmentalize companies, for example, ESG, purpose, culture, etc.? Are we trying too hard? Is it starting to lose its meaning? Does anyone want to take that question?
I'll give you a quick, just a quick view from my perspective, and this is very much with my kind of ESG sustainability hat on. I think the industry in some ways has done itself a huge disservice through the language that has been used. And, you know, the person that asked the question quoted a number of examples there. But then you talk about sustainability, corporate responsibility, corporate social responsibility, creating shared value. And I do think it's quite challenging for companies. And I think what ideally we could do with is a much simpler model. And the way that we looked at it with the Chartered Governance Institute was we described something called purposeful governance. So we said, as a company, you need to understand your corporate purpose. That then informs you who are your key stakeholder groups. And you then need to put a governance framework in place that allows you to take account of the interests of those different stakeholder groups and to balance them so that hopefully then long term you will be sustainable. And so we tried to sort of put this framing around it. And I think some more work on that and agreeing the common language, the common terminology, getting common understanding will actually make it easier for lots of companies to try and not feel like they're trying to put the camel through the eye of the needle.
Thanks, Jill. Does anyone else want to take that? Because we do have a lot of other questions. That was a very good answer anyway.
Oh, I'll right. just this add, one, add a bit.
Michael, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was just thinking that I think it's probably a question of emphasis on company, and that's, I think, something that companies may not have been realized that, you know, environmental and societal aspects are important to the business of the company. I think we are probably in a stage of evolution where we're trying to find the right balance and solution to take these factors into account. We are seeing progress, and I think at some point in time we'll get there, and that will be, I think, then mainstream, and I think that should be the ultimate objective.
Thanks, Michael. Got another interesting question, and it speaks to the future of as well. The notion of corporate governance is a product of the evolution of the modern corporation. So it started, you know, since the 17th, 18th century, right, with the East India Trading Company. As we see new concepts of corporations emerge, for example, the decentralized autonomous organization, as companies, as the form of a company evolves, how much of the corporate governance philosophy do you think will continue to be relevant? Anyone has. It's a very philosophical question, and I like it for that. Will it continue? Will corporate governance? Yeah, go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, I think as what Jill said, I think even though the concept or the mode of the corporations may evolve, I think the fundamentals of how you manage a company, the pillars of what is good in order for your governance structure, I think it still stands. And of course, it may some of aspects may still evolving as the whole journey goes on. But I think you can't really dismiss all those what we have said or what we have been think that is good for in terms of the governance or how the board or the directors overseeing the company. I think that still stands. So yeah, it's my short answer to this question, I think.
It's a very good answer. Thanks, Kelly.
Patricia, just, you know, yes, I think governance Jill, is important. Yes. We're talking about corporate governance today, but it's so important for all organisations, NGOs, governments, you know, and so I think however sort of companies continue to morph over time, I think any organisation needs to think about these issues.
Michael, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question I've been thinking. I think we have seen how the corporate governance code has evolved since its introduction to take into account new areas or new expectations, new baseline. For example, in terms of definitions of independence, for example, the focus on sustainability. I think the core concept of having a proper system and process and people in place is there because we're looking at how a group of people can come together to achieve an objective. So we need to think about how to organize effectively, properly, and with good accountability. So I think that core concept has not changed. But as to the actual practices, it has evolved and it will continue to evolve. And that is, I think, the beauty of having a corporate governance code to allow for this even in what's best practice.
Yeah, and just a few quick points for me, Patricia. I mean, we work with a number of new economy, Web3 type companies, and the responsibility that those kind of newer economy companies have to their stakeholders is still largely the same. You know, so I would argue that everything we've discussed today is just as relevant. But as you know, Michael just suggested that you know, corporate governance is not a static construct; it will continue to evolve. And so, something that we're focused on with all companies we work on, regardless if it's a new state, you know, it's a very new company, or if it's been around for 150 years, is bringing the outside in. What is expected of you today? What do your stakeholders expect? What obligations do you need to meet? And you have to continue having that discussion all the time because it just continues to evolve.
Thanks, Lauren. Next question is a simpler one, less philosophical. Is the ESG rating process actually driving improved governance practices in the region? So are you seeing a link between what's being asked for in ESG and actual better corporate governance?
I'm happy to take a stab, Patricia, and say, yes, I think it does. I think it's obviously more important what you do as a company rather than what you disclose. But I touched on earlier, for example, with board diversity, and this was another question around the focus on gender, around gender diversity, the fact that there was that new disclosure requirement enabled me to go and have that conversation with my chairman and therefore to change the way that we operate as a business. And I think particularly, you know, we talked about the compliance burden on SMEs, but I actually think for governance professionals in SMEs, they can really use these disclosure requirements, the rating processes, try and have some of those challenging conversations with their chairman and their boards. And so it's often a way that I would advise fellow company secretaries to kind of kick off some of these internal discussions.
Thanks, Jill.
I can offer a quick perspective, Patricia. I mean, do I see increased emphasis on ESG ratings as helping? Too often, I think the conversation we have here, and I'll speak for Hong Kong specifically because I'm sitting here, is that how the ratings will impact cost of capital. So it's being viewed from that lens, which is, yes, that's good. That's important for the organisation. You can't argue against that. But I'd like to see the conversation or the drivers for improved ESG ratings to be for different reasons. And, you know, often what we see here is also a sort of an element of competition, so making sure that your ratings are better than the corporate that's, you know, benchmarked against. So I'd like to, I think, you know, things are moving in the right direction, but I think the conversations and the rationale for targeting improved ratings needs to change.
That's a good point. And, you know, I'm going to ask one question that speaks to that issue as well. So someone is saying that, you know, what they've observed is that companies start to consider governance only in their pre-IPO period or when they're about to undertake a major capital markets exercise. So I guess that's the start of the box-ticking mindset, right? Is there a better way for, I guess, for the ecosystem of the corporate governance world to encourage companies to think about best practices in a different way, not just before a capital markets exercise.
Or maybe I can share some views on this. I think it started changing actually in the past when we talk to listed companies, the moment they started to think about governance is after they list. Now they're moving a bit ahead to before their list, because it's the time when they need to find the pre-IPO investors, the cornerstone. So they need to deal with the listing process, and we and as the exchange, we also impose regulations for the listing applicants, right? And that's why we urge them to start thinking about this kind of issues that are important in the future. And so I think they do shifting a bit, but ultimately, okay, how you can urge like non-public companies start thinking about it, I think it's all, again, it all coming from the mindset of the directors, whether they truly see the benefits, they appreciate the benefits of having this, how they organize the company, how they manage the company, what can be more effective, who do they accountable for, who because they don't have really like public companies minority shareholders, they may be just the director, maybe the boss himself. So I think the whole concept, it has to be that who recognize the true benefits of having a good governance in order to push them. Because as the exchange, I don't think we have any role, because we can't really compel them to do anything at that stage. But I think it is important for the whole ecosystem to be built in order to push this forward, I think.
But that's encouraging that this is already progress. Does anyone want to take a stab at that question before I move to the last one? Because I'm conscious that we have only 3 minutes left. Got another really interesting one. All right. Okay. So this expands on something we discussed earlier, which is about diversity. When we were discussing the notion of diversity, we did focus a bit on gender, but Michael touched on the idea of diversity of thought. What can the regulators do, or what can everybody do to ensure there is broader diversity in thought at the board level beyond gender? Michael, do you want
maybe
to?
Maybe I'll add on. That? Yeah, I'll add on that our rules and requirements are specific in asking companies to consider a board diversity policy, and it should contain diversity aspects such as gender, skills, and experience, and any other relevant aspects of diversity that the company thinks that the board requires. So I think the question really is from the company's perspective, as the board is looking at itself, where are the gaps in terms of where things it needs to plug? And these are the aspects of diversity that the board should be looking at. From our perspective, we're asking them to consider it, asking them to set targets around it and to report on their progress towards meeting these targets. I think investors have a huge role to play in this aspect. We've seen global fund managers step up, vote against director appointments if they feel that the board is not sufficiently diverse. Thus far, I think the focus has been on gender, but I think individual investors, individual fund managers can make that assessment of companies as to whether or not there are other aspects that they wish the board to cover.
And I wonder if Jill has some other thoughts on that, because I think you touched on it as well. Like, you know, how do you think about diversity as it relates to a company's strategy or purpose?
Sure. So at MTR, the way we've approached this has been to put in place a skills matrix. So looking at our corporate strategy, looking at the skills we have available on our board, trying to identify whether or not there are any gaps there, and we continue to do that. I think for me, the kind of conversation about gender is great, because it's a very obvious aspect of diversity. And so it just opens the door to having those conversations about the benefits of diversity and thinking about diversity in all of its different aspects. And I have to say, we had our AGM recently here in Hong Kong, and the questions we were getting from institutional shareholders on some of our director appointments were absolutely around this issue of diversity. One institutional investor, I think, has a minimum threshold that you have to have a target of 30%. And if not, then they will not vote in favour of new director appointments or a chair's appointment on the basis that they're not supporting and driving that. So absolutely, it's a broader concept, but I think gender is a good way into the conversation.
Right. And on that note, I would like to thank everybody for participating. Thank you, Jill, Lauren, Kelly, and Michael for participating. And thank you to the people who threw in questions. They were very, very well thought out and expanded our conversation. Thank you for joining us for this last in this series. But, you know, if you enjoyed it, feel free to reach out and we can have conversations about this topic. And definitely, Tanea will be hosting more webinars around this and other topics that are close to a CEO, CEO's heart. Thank you for joining me with this, and, you know, a round of applause to everybody.
Thanks, Patricia.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.